Good morning. I'd like to call the meeting of the House Education Committee to order. It is 8:03, Monday, February 2nd, 2026, in the Betty Davis Room, 106 in the Capitol. Members present are, to my right, Rep. Eichscheid, Rep. Underwood, Rep. Schwanke, Rep. Dibert, Rep. Elam, Co-Chair Rep. Hemshute, and myself, Rep. Story. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please take this time to silence your cell phones during the meeting. Thank you. I want to thank Kale Brown, the House Education Secretary from Records, and Chloe Miller from the Juno LYO for staffing the committee today, and our co-chair committee aides, Tammy Smith and Ella Lubin. First of all, I want to say happy Black History Month. It is the 100-year anniversary. It was in 1926. It was established by Dr. Carter Woodson. And their theme this year is just celebrating the impact of 100 years of Black life and history and what has the impacts that it has had on America. So we will look forward to quite a few events this month on that. Today we will hear two bills, my House Bill 261 on education funding process, which addresses average daily membership, also known as the student count measures. Following that hearing, we will hear Senate Bill 6, Asian American Programs, from Senator Gray Jackson. At this time, I will be turning the gavel over to House Education Co-Chair Hemshute. I'm going to take a quick at ease.
Hey, good morning. I invite Representative Story and her staff, Tammy Smith, to identify yourselves for the record and begin your presentation on House Bill 261. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. I am Rep. Andy Story. I have the honor of representing District 3, Haynes, Skagway, Clackamas, Gustavus, and North Juno.
I am Tammy Smith, for the record, staff to Representative Story.
Please imagine for a moment that we, the legislature, must pass a state budget by March 31st, but we won't get our revenue projections until May. On top of that, we have to issue notices of non-referrals to staff, otherwise known as pink slips, weeks before the shot-in-the-dark budget is ready. If there is a chance, we might have to reduce the workforce. Of course, we'd be making blind decisions and dismissing talented staff simply because of the calendar forced on us. We, as responsible lawmakers, would not tolerate that. Yet we force school districts to budget in such an irrational way, and it makes no sense. This backwards budgeting consumes a great deal of valuable time to reshuffle numbers once the budget is finally signed by the governor during the summer or May or June, months after pink slips have been sent out or programs canceled. And of course, the teachers who were let go often unnecessarily have to move on. From personal experience, this causes much pain in the community. After the fallout from the budget, relationships must be repaired. Parents argued against each other about which programs to cut. They pleaded with the school board not to raise class sizes or cut favorite programs. There can be hard feelings between administrators and staff. Employers report that potential hires decline positions due to lack of investment in our children's education, even though the legislature did just approve new revenues. This affects our economy. I want to take a moment to understand the mechanics of this process and how we can turn it around and assure some predictability. I'm going to turn to this PowerPoint right now for further explanation of what the bill does to improve the funding budget process and create some more stability through the timing of the student count. So, education funding process. The education funding process centers around the student count, better known as the average daily membership. How districts count students is the basis for budgeting, because, of course, the student count drives state funding. In Juneau, this starts in the spring of the school year before the new school year starts. The school board looks at the current student counts in each grade. They move the students up. They move the students up in a chart, so you can predict first graders, they're going to move up to second. So that's part of the calculation. Boards often work with an economist. They give a low, medium, and high projection based on births, based on the rates of immigration and outmigration. But it is a guess that the district will be building its budget on. Slide two, please. Here is a chart of the current education budget process. As noted, Alaska law determines public school funding based on the average daily membership count or count student count. So you can see the first bar way over in May. So that is the May prior the school board, or it could be in April, is deciding what their student count is going to be for the next year. And that's what the budget, part of the budget, will be based on. So then October comes around and the count is calculated using the district's 20-day count period. So they, through that whole 20 days, counting to the quitting at the end, the last day of February is the last day of the 20-day count. Then this goes to deed, and there's true-ups and verifying students. If there's There might be a double count of students. Once moved, they decide which student, which district the student belongs to, and that process goes for a few months. While this is all happening, the governor's proposed budget's released. Community members start meeting on the budget. The school districts provide budget requests to the local government. They're oftentimes many of the municipalities, they have a deadline that it must be to the city and borough of Juneau, for an example, because, of course, they're building their budgets, and they have to know how much the school district will need that year. And next slide, please. I did want to point out, I didn't want to forget that in March and April of every year, that is currently nationwide, and we are in a teacher shortage, that is recruitment season. And so down south, if teachers are thinking they're going to move, if you're thinking you might want to move within district, people are looking around. Especially they're looking around if there's been a lot of budget projections and they're not sure what the number is going to be. And unfortunately, because our budget funding process doesn't happen till May, or we don't give our money for sure what we're going to be giving, there's a lot of stress and chaos. Unfortunately, if we do not pass our budget, so districts know what they're going to be getting, contract notifications have to go out like the pink slips.
Do you want to take questions as you go, or do you want us to say
thank you for that question? You know, I would like to just keep going.
Okay.
We've got quite a few people here today, and I think your questions might be answered as we go along. So thank you for that.
Sure.
So I just wanted to point out at the bottom of that chart is one very important, because it happens here in Alaska so much. Once the budget is approved, if there's not a veto, if it's signed, the districts have to go back and redo their budgets and try and rehire if staff is still around for that.
And Rep. Story, I am going to stop you just a second. You misspoke at one point. I just want to clarify. I think you meant end of October for the last day of the count. And I think you accidentally said February. But I want to confirm that what you meant was the count ends on the last day of October, not February.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it does.
I think you have February on the brain because it's...
I think that's the one thing we all know. I think a lot of times people don't realize that really the budget process starts when we, the school board members, project what the student count's going to be in the spring of the year.
And that kind of kicks off the whole budget
process. Yes, and then we've got the student count period, that 20-day count period in October.
And I think February popped out because it's Groundhog Day. We're all waiting to see, is there going to be more winter? Okay.
Yes.
Please continue.
Yeah. Next slide, please. So this current funding process undermines families and communities' confidence in our educational system. It leads to stress for families and communities, uncertainty for staff, teacher and staff turnover, focus on redoing budgets instead of student achievement. We spend all this time on budgets when we want to be focused on student learning. This whole process has poor economic impacts for Alaska. There's a lot of volatility. Next slide, please. You can see it by looking at news headlines. Alaska Education Funding Dispute Sees Pink Slips, Profound Concern in Rural Schools. Ketchikan Schools Deliver 52 Layoff Notifications, which leaders say are unlikely to materialize. Alaska school districts get a one-time funding boost. It came too late for many teachers. Alaska school officials say layoff notices are going out. Budget uncertainty costing districts. Next slide, please. Well, there are some other ways. There are different ways to do the student count alternatives. I am on the Task Force on Education Funding. In November, we read review of Alaska's funding programs in 2015. One of the authors, Justin Silverstein, is on the line today. If there are any questions about how we do student counts, in that hearing and in that report in that hearing, solutions were put forth, and there were suggestions for Alaska. It says Alaska should create a three-year averaging approach statewide to replace the current hold harmless provision to ensure greater funding stability. It could also provide districts with more stability in planning, as districts would not be so concerned about unexpected changes in enrollments at the October count period. About 19 states use an approach that either averages, combines, or provides the better of multiple years of student counts. As you can look at this busy chart or this busy page right here, 10 states, of the 19 states who do an average, 10 states use the current year, 9 of which only use the prior years. Generally, school districts who have taxing authority choose to use the current year to be part of their three-year average because they have the ability to tax and add revenue. States such as ours, where there's no ability for school board members to raise revenue, tend to use the prior years. And this slide came from Augenblick, Palish, and Associates. It came from their task force, their review of education programs in 2015. And we, Justin Silverstein, who was part of that, was also before us in November. And we're fortunate to have him online today if you have any questions at the about the student counts and how they are done across the United States. Next slide, please. So I took the recommendation in the report of taking the previous three-year averaging of the student count or the previous year, whichever is greater. The reason why the previous year is a choice is when you're doing a three-year averaging, you might see that, hey, this prior year I got a bump in students, and you know you're going to be having those students, so you take the prior year. So you can take the average or you can take the prior year, whichever is greater. And in the statute it just says you will take whichever is greater, which I know a district would want to. It is important to note that if DEED has the authority, if all of a sudden there was a huge bump in your student count and you needed to meet the needs of many more students, that they can step in and help. And that happened just this last fall when there was the terrible typhoon, actually, Halong, and they have really helped the Anchorage School District be able to meet the needs of the students and fund some more dollars. So there is flexibility. In my speaking with education leaders, anything that can help give stability is very much appreciated. Knowing your student count number that your budget depends on is critical. So with a previous three-year average, it allows districts to know their revenue based on firm student count data starting in July 2026. So we know the student counts have been vetted thoroughly by DEED. It is an appropriate time budget process. It allows for teacher and staff contracts to be signed earlier, reducing turnover and making the state more competitive in retaining and recruiting teachers. It smooths the loss of student enrollment by removing the hold harmless position provision. Thank you. Helps small districts absorb large resource shifts in any given year, and enables student communities to focus more on student achievement than budgets. And it increases public confidence in education here in Alaska. So, House Bill 261 calls for the calculation of a district student count for the first year to be based on the average daily membership of the district's previous three-year average, which we ADM, or which is another word for student count, or the previous year's student count, whichever is greater. So I wanted to put this slide on here because I've had a few questions about that. And so we just had our student count in October, and right now they're trying to verify it, and they're probably coming to the end of that with DEED. But that student count is not a part of the prior 3 year. We're really going to be taking the counts from 24, 23, and 22. So the districts could take an average of those 3 years, or they could take the October 2024 count. And that comes from Section 16, that definition in the sectional analysis. So another thing that happens in the bill is the intensive needs students, who we all know have complex needs and may require additional staffing to meet their individual education plans. So importantly, House Bill 261 permits the district to adjust the intensive student count mid-year to accommodate intensive needs students who are new to the district after the current count date. So there's really four ways to use the intensive needs students count: the three-year averaging, the previous year, whichever is greater, or the current ADM count, or there will be a mid-year adjustment in February. This is something that was, I know the Alaska Association of School Boards has a resolution about doing, looking at the another count date mid-February. They've had that, I'm sure, at least a decade, because when a student comes in, they're 13 times the BSA, and you are hiring another person to help give them supports, and so they want to make sure that districts are making sure that student has the supports they need. Next slide, please. Here is another part, and this was another recommendation in the report, help the funding cliff in the part of law under facilities constituting a school. And this was something that I learned about from the Skagway School District. They're in our education policy, in our statutes. There is a statute about small schools of 100 and 425 districts. And this happens when, So it smooths out funding cliffs when school membership in small districts falls below 100 or 425 students. It recognizes when small changes in school and district level student counts may lead to large changes in funding. So Skagway, who is in the low 100s. In our formula, a community can pick when you have a schools over 100, like 101. They can pick to divide their K through 12 grade programs into two schools. So you have elementary through sixth grade, and then you have sixth through 12th grade, and that helps you to meet the needs of those students. But if you have these two schools and all of a sudden you flow to 99, just one below 100, you only get funding for one school. And so it's just the loss of one student, but it's a huge revenue drop, and it really impacts your programs. And this was brought up when Augenblick, Palish, and Associates were doing their review in 2015, and one of the recommendations was to smooth out those funding cliffs. And so there is the three-year averaging. I have put that into the bill before you. Next slide, please. And then lastly, for alternative schools, with an ADM of fewer than 175 students would now be counted as their own school rather than as part of the biggest school in the district. Being counted as part of the school in the district with the highest student count of mainstream kids means that alternative programs, which typically require smaller class sizes and more personalized services, those students may be deprived of much needed funds. So as an example, here in Juneau, our biggest school is our high school. And in the school size formula, once you're over 750 students, your school size adjustment for economies of scales, they're not getting 1.0 anymore for that student. They're getting like a 0.86. And then you take the alternative school, which is, I don't know the number for Juneau's right now, 90 maybe. You take those students, put them into the largest school, and you're getting a 0.86 for them rather than a 1 or another size factor. And you just don't have as much resources that you can use for some kids who need some specialized services. So that was a lot, but in one way, it's very clear the needs, and it's also clear that it's time to fix the education funding process and better address student enrollment changes so we can focus on student achievement. This House Bill 261 is just one step forward. Education funding needs still must be resolved. We'll still wrestle with what should be the base student allocation number, but there are things we can do to stabilize our budget process by looking at how we can change student enrollment and how we do student counts in the state of Alaska. So I am going to have Ms. Smith go over the sectional analysis, and then I was thinking we could go right into the presentations.
And before we do all of that, I should have mentioned, it's here and I didn't notice that I was supposed to remind everybody or let you know that we do have Justin Silverstein, who's the CEO from Augenblick, Palish, and Associates online for questions about the presentation and how we do student count in Alaska. We also have Ledge Legal available to answer questions, and Connor Bell from Ledge Finance is available. And then we have a whole bunch of invited testifiers. So would you like to do the sectional analysis and then see if there are questions about your presentation?
I think I would like to go through everyone because I know time is precious, and then at the end come back and help field questions.
Okay, great. So Ms. Smith.
Yeah, good morning again, Co-Chair Hamshut and committee. For the record, I am Tammy Smith, staff to Representative Story. So for sections one, we have amends AS 1403-410E to conform to AS 1417-600 under former AS 1417-500. In section two, this amends 1411-100 0A through M to conform to AS 1417-600 under former AS 1417-500. Section 3 amends AS 1411-100P to A through L to conform to AS 1417-600 under former AS 1417-500. And Section 4 amends AS 1411-100 100 Q1A and B, and it conforms to AS 1417-600 under former AS 1417-500. So you can see a lot of what you see in the initial part of the bill is that we have language that is just conforming to the statutes that are there. In Section 5, we also amend AS 1416-050A to B with conforming language, changing AS 1417-500 to AS 1417-910 to AS 1417-505 to 1417-910. Section 6, AS 1417-410B1 amends by deleting E through G. This section eliminates the 5% adjustment allowance that school districts use in determining average daily membership, the ADM, commonly known as the Hold Harmless Clause. Please note that due to conforming changes, A and F are relettered from A and B respectively. F through J are relettered to conform as determined through throughout Section 6. Section 7 amends 1417-420A, redefining intensive student funding enrollment counts, allowing for the intensive student count to be equal to or greater than enrollments taken by October 15th of the previous fiscal year, or by selecting one of the following enrollment count options: use of the current enrollment fiscal year, use of the second count by February 15th of the current fiscal year, should the district choose to conduct an additional student enrollment count. 3, by using the district's 3-year average intensive enrollment count, whichever is greater. So in other words, there's 4 options for the intensive needs funding: previous fiscal year, use of the current fiscal year, use of a second count by February 15th of the current fiscal year, or by using the district's 3-year average intensive student enrollment count, whichever is greater. Section 8 amends AS 1417-450G by adding a new subsection that states that the calculation of a district's student count must be based on the previous district's 3-year average ADM reported in 1417-600 or the ADM reported in the previous fiscal year, whichever is greater. Section 9 amends 1417-600 by adding that the report submitted by the district for its ADM count period shall include the district's previous 3-year average ADM, student count information the department determines is necessary to calculate community and charter school ADM, that relate to the district under 1417-905 in order to determine the amount of the district state aid for the succeeding fiscal year. The district shall also include in the district report the number of special education students who needed or received intensive services on October 15th of that count period, which the department shall use to determine funding for intensive services for the succeeding fiscal year under AS 1417-420A to A and D, and, if applicable, for the current fiscal year under AS 1420A to B. Section 10 amends AS 14600 by adding a new subsection from AS 14500B through G to AS 14600C through H. This is conforming language due to the language being moved from AS 1417-500. Section 11 amends 1417-600E by adding a new subsection D1-2 to read that a district may not include the district's ADM, a student in a district-wide early education program provided by the district. And again, this is conforming language as in AS 1417-600E. Section 12 amends the process under which 1417-610A of when the department distributes payments to school districts for a fiscal year based on a district's student count date reported in the previous fiscal year under AS 14600. Section 13 amends AS 1417-610 by adding a new subsection D-12. This subsection conforms to AS 1417-428-2B or C, the distribution of funds among districts entitled to additional intensive services funding based on a new student count in February. Section 14, AS 1417-905A, amends the language that allows alternative schools with fewer than 175 ADM to be counted as one school. Section 15, AS 1417-905, is amended by adding a new subsection determining a charter or community's ADM by using a three-year average or previous year count, whichever is greater. Section 16, AS 1417-990, is amended by adding a new paragraph defining previous three-year average. I am just going to say under Section 17 and 18, those are all conforming language. You can see the statutes there that are adjusted. That's 17 and 18. 19, you can see the conforming language, repealing the AS 1400 sections, and then Section 20 amends the uncodified code to set forth transition language to the new ADM calculation, and then for Sections 21 and 22 provided, 21 provides for an effective date for Sections 11 and 19 to take effect on the effective date in Section 47, Chapter 40, SLA 2022, and Section 22 provides for the effective date, except for in the language stated above, of July 1st, 2026. Thank you.
And you can take a deep breath. That was a lot. Okay. If we're ready, Rep. Story, I think we'll move on then to the first online invited testimony, and I hope I don't say this wrong, but I probably will. Brittany Cioni Haywood, president of the Juneau School Board. And before you begin your comments, I want to recognize that Representative Bynum joined us quite a while ago, so thank you for being here this morning. And Ms. Cioni Haywood, you'll correct me if I've got that wrong. Please identify yourself for the record and begin your presentation on House Bill 261. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much. Good morning, co-chairs Hemshute and Story, and members of the House Education Committee. For the record, my name is Brittany Cioni Haywood. Very good.
Pretty close.
And I am currently serving as the president of the Juneau School Board, Juneau School District Board of Education. Thank you so much for the opportunity to provide some invited testimony on this bill. I was sworn in as the Juneau Board of Education member in October of 2023, and I did actually have to go look that up because it feels so much longer. Approximately 2 months later, it was discovered that we had a major budgetary crisis due mainly to some accounting errors, but another factor was an overly optimistic enrollment projection. That crisis was incredibly difficult on our community, and we are still trying to clean up the debris field that was left behind in the wake of very difficult decisions, including repairing relationships and rebuilding trust with staff, students, and families. My goal here today is to explain why the changes proposed in this bill, particularly around school size and enrollment stability, are important to students, and how these changes improve predictability and stability, increasing complexity around the foundation formula. I think we can all agree that students deserve access to consistent programs and services regardless of when they enroll or which school they attend. The changes in this bill will help the funding formula align more with the reality of how students move through our schools. So here's a process. This is a little summary of our process. It illustrates our budget development timeline and challenges that school districts operate under each year. So my district is currently, right now as we speak, working on our FY 2027, which is next year's budget. So we're in that development. We receive our adjusted or our average daily membership in December, adjusted, for this fiscal year that we're currently operating in. That's 5 months after the start of our school year. It was 9 months after we initially submitted our budget. Districts are required to build budgets and issue staff contracts months in advance before enrollment is certified and the foundation funding is finalized. Staffing decisions have to be made in advance of knowing what that revenue is going to be. To give a concrete example, a few years ago, our spring enrollment projections were higher than what was ultimately certified after the October count. By the time those final numbers were known, contracts had already been issued, and the school year was underway. In this case, we had to limit spending mid-year to account for the discrepancy created by the enrollment uncertainty. Most of our budget is spent on instructional support, teachers, support staff, classroom supplies, etc., and approximately 89% is for personnel costs, which makes budgeting adjustments, particularly mid-year, extremely challenging. Those spending limits were disruptive to our staff and, most importantly, to our students. Timing mismatch districts manage under this current system is incredibly difficult as school boards try to develop budgets that directly impact both our teachers and our students. So districts currently budget based on a lengthy list of question marks and assumptions. HB 261 would help the funding move closer to a model where revenue behaves more predictably before districts are required to finalize budgets and staffing decisions. Knowing revenue prior to budget development process would minimize the disruptive realities of our funding uncertainty. It does this by allowing funding calculations to rely on greater prior year average daily membership or the three-year ADM that was just presented by Representative Story, rather than reacting to kind of a single year fluctuation. This does not eliminate accountability to enrollment trends. Instead, it smooths short-term volatility so districts can adjust responsibly over time without disruptive mid-year corrections. All other budget mechanisms would stay in place, such as the enrollment October count that was priorly discussed. Historically, Alaskans have relied on hold harmless provisions to respond to enrollment declines. Those mechanisms are designed to soften the impact, but they generally take effect after enrollment changes have already occurred. The bill would shift this approach by allowing districts to use greater of the prior year ADM or a three-year average ADM when calculating our funding. Both approaches are intended to provide stability, but the three-year average provides predictability earlier in the process when districts are actually building their budgets and issuing contracts. Our school board holds around 10 to 12 meetings to develop a budget, and then we often have multiple revisions after a budget is submitted. If I remember correctly from this past year, we revised in July, September, and October, and we're about to do another one. This bill would help eliminate some of those budget question marks and assumptions and hopefully build a bit more trust with staff, families, and students. This change does not prevent enrollment trends from being reflected over time, but it does reduce some year-to-year volatility and it improves alignment between funding calculations and operational decision-making. Again, it isn't about increasing funding, it's about stabilizing that funding so we can adjust responsibly over time. The bill also addresses, as was presented in the prior slides, the funding equity and parity issue and how school size is treated across districts Under current law, the way an alternative program is counted depends not just on the size of the school, but the total size of the district. In larger districts, a relatively small drop in enrollment can trigger immediate consolidation for funding purposes, resulting in a much lower school size multiplier. In smaller districts, similar student populations are counted in a way that produces more stable funding. The result is a meaningful funding gap for programs serving similar numbers of students based solely on district size rather than student need. And this would impact our alternative program. So HB 61 removes this inconsistency by allowing alternative programs with an ADM of 175 or less to be counted as its own school, regardless of the district size. And as Representative Story mentioned, currently our alternative high school gets lumped in with our large high school, and so that does reduce our multiplier. And those students often do need different services or mechanisms. There's sometimes they join the school proactively. Sometimes it's the regular high school wasn't working for them, and so they need something different. House Bill 261 improves how intensive special education services are funded as well. Currently, funding relies heavily on a single count date, even though districts are legally obligated to serve students with intensive needs whenever they enroll throughout the school year. Students who need intensive services do not arrive on a schedule. As you can see in the graph, the Juneau School District, we have tracked the number of students who have entered our district after the October count. Those students still need immediate services, supports, and staffing, even though they were not fully reflected in the funding tied to a single date. Districts, including ours, do not turn away students mid-year. We're legally and ethically obligated to meet those student IEPs and provide a free, appropriate public education in the least restrictive manner as soon as they enroll. This bill would allow districts to use the greater multiple count days or a three-year average intensive student count. This does not change eligibility or service requirements. It simply aligns the funding to real student needs and reduces unnecessary volatility. So in summary, HB 261 is not about increasing funding. It's about making sure students aren't affected by uncertainty that's built into our current system. It's about increasing transparency and certainty. It allows districts to focus on improving curriculum, materials, and services for students. It will help build trust and transparency with stakeholders and eliminate the pitting of different groups against each other in the fight for very limited funding. This bill will provide more predictability, better budgeting, and allow districts to focus on what we should be focused on, student learning, achievement, and good learning environments, instead of redoing budgets over and over and over, probably again. When funding is predictable and fair, districts can plan responsibly, and that stability will show up in classrooms, programs, and services for students. Predictable funding isn't about school systems, it's about stability for students. Ganeshish, thank you for your opportunity to testify. I'm happy to address questions when they are taken.
Okay, and it looks like we're gonna just keep rolling through, I think, four more testifiers at least, and then circle back to questions, and our goal is to be wrapped up with this bill by 9:20. We'll see if we make that. Mm-hmm. The next person up, thank you so much, President Choni Haywood. Okay, we're going to move on now to Dr. Luke Meinert, Superintendent at Fairbanks North Star Borough School District. Dr. Meinert, good morning. Welcome for joining us. Welcome to the committee, and thank you for joining us today. You could identify yourself for the record and begin your presentation on House Bill 261.
Good morning. Thanks for having me, co-chairs Representative Hemshute and Representative Story and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. And for the record, I'm Dr. Luke Miner, superintendent of the Fairbanks North Star Borough School District. I'd like to start my remarks by thanking this body for the historic BSA increase in last year's session and for continuing your work to look at ways you can support our Alaskan students. I'm here to speak in support of House Bill 261, specifically the proposal to base district funding on a three-year average daily membership, as well as the related changes to funding for intensive resource students. At its core, this bill is about stability. This bill helps to bring about stability for students, for staff, and for school districts that are navigating long-term enrollment changes and chaotic funding environments, not only at the state level, but at the local and federal levels as well. With this bill, there's an excellent opportunity to provide districts with more stability and predictability, which is greatly needed. Next slide, please. To understand why this matters, I want to start with our enrollment reality in the Fairbanks North Star Borough School District. In the last 10 years, our peak enrollment in the last decade was 13,851 students. Our current actual enrollment for the 25-26 school year is 11,200 students. This is a loss of approximately 261 students, or nearly 19% of our student population. Fortunately, this is not a short-term dip. It's a structural long-term change that districts like ours and most districts throughout the state are experiencing. And if you zoom out even further, this loss is even greater as the peak of our enrollment peaked out at over 16,000 students over 20 years ago. As folks look at our enrollment trends, many assume this change in enrollment is solely due to students moving to correspondence education. While there has been some migration to correspondence, our biggest loss of students in the past 3 years is families moving completely out of state. This is coupled with changing demographics of families having fewer children, which makes for a perfect storm for schools having to continue to do more with less. Fixed costs don't disappear for districts, even if students do. Transportation routes continue to stay the same length. Buildings require the same amount of fuel oil to keep our students warm. Internet needs to be operational to keep our students and staff connected. And staffing is not as easily reduced as students don't come into our schools in tidy bundles that coincide with the state's class size targets. Next slide, please. At the same time enrollment has declined, state funding has not kept pace with rising costs. The BSA increased from 5680 in 2014 to 5960 in 2024, which was a 5% increase over those 10 years. During that same period, costs for staffing, healthcare, utilities, transportation, and special education services did not significantly increase well above that 5% increase. As a result, districts are educating students with fewer dollars, fewer staff, and greater needs. Next slide, please. The problem is not just declining enrollment, it's how the funding system responds to it. Under current law, funding is based on a single year's enrollment, which creates fiscal whiplash for school districts. Here are our recent actual enrollment numbers. 12,453 students in 23-24, in 24-25, 11,793 students, and 25-26, 11,200 students. Each of these year-to-year drops trigger an immediate funding reduction, forcing districts to make abrupt decisions with little time to plan for the change, and more importantly, prevents districts from future planning. Compounding this challenge, staffing decisions often must be made before enrollment counts are finalized, leaving districts to act with incomplete information. Districts do not have the ability to gamble with budgeting for too many staff members, nor is it easy to plan new reading or math intervention programs, not knowing what our funding will be from year to year. Next slide, please. Fortunately, this bill provides a practical alternative and an excellent structural change that is utilized by many other states in our country. For Fairbanks, using our actual enrollment data from the last 3 years, our three-year ADM average would be 11,815 students. Under current law, our funding immediately dropped to 11,200 students. For our district, the difference represents approximately $5.1 million in funding stability. This is a way to transition responsibility through long-term enrollment change. This approach does not hide enrollment decline. It phases it in responsibly, allowing districts to adjust through attrition and careful planning rather than sudden layoffs and program eliminations. These savings, and more importantly, provide more stability and predictability, and could have helped us and Fairbanks prevent class size increases, which is the elimination of teaching positions, the decimation of many of our programs, and fewer school closures. Next slide, please. Even with careful planning at the local level and increased revenue from the state, in Fairbanks, we've closed 7 schools in the last 5 years. We've had to eliminate more than 360 jobs. We've increased class sizes, and we've reduced elementary art, elementary band and orchestra, gifted and talented programs, activity funds, and supply budgets throughout all of our schools. These are reductions to educational opportunities and not efficiencies. Next slide, please. At the same time enrollment has declined, student needs have increased. And one of those areas that they've increased tremendously is in special education services. The amount of students in special education within our district has increased over 21% over the last 10 years and 28.5% over just the last 5 years. These students require consistent, intensive, and costly supports. By allowing districts a true-up after our October count period for our intensive students, which have the highest needs and require the highest services, support, and resources are needed, this will provide school districts with an opportunity to provide these students with greater services and support than they are currently getting. Next slide, please. Funding instability worsens staffing challenges. We continue to face staffing challenges, particularly in special education and specialized support roles, while competing statewide and nationally for qualified educators. House Bill 261 does not increase enrollment, but it does provide increased predictability. Predictability that can maintain class sizes, prevent schools from closing, and to maintain intervention services that allow all Alaskan students to be successful. If we want better outcomes from students, we need better and more predictable systems from our state. Thank you for your time and consideration, and thank you for all that you're doing on behalf of our Alaskan students.
Thank you, Dr. Minert. And we are holding questions till we get to the very end. I want to acknowledge that Senator Gray Jackson has joined us. She does have a presentation on her bill later in the meeting. We're going to go next to Rod Morrison, Superintendent of Southeast Island School District. Good morning. Mr. Morrison, glad you're here.
My name is Rod Morrison. Can you hear me okay?
Yep, you sound great.
Okay. Co-chairs, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to testify today. For the record, my name is Rod Morrison. I'm speaking on behalf of Southeast Island School District and the Remote Rural Education Attendance Area Schools, or REAA. I'm here today to express strong support for House Bill 261. As an REA district, next slide, please. As an REA district, we serve small, remote island communities across Southeast Alaska. Our schools are more than just an educational building. They're the center of our communities. They provide stability, opportunity, and connection for students, families, and places where resources are limited and distances are great. Next slide. One of our greatest challenges in rural districts that we face is enrollment volatility. And that comes from students that may move in and out due to housing, jobs, or just migration of following the resources. Small changes in our student count create major funding swings. Instability, disruptive staffing, course offerings, and student supports are all challenges we face. Unlike larger districts that might be a little more stable, in a small school, a gain or a loss of a few students can dramatically affect funding. Next slide, please. I wanted to kind of show you what our enrollment, and we have 8 different campuses we serve: Coffin Cove, Hollis, Kassan, Nocatee, Port Alexander, Thorne Bay, Whale Pass, and our homeschool program, AK Trails. And I want to, you can look, Port Alexander dropped from 22 students to 11 and back up to 19. That's quite a swing when it comes to funding. The big one, though, is Whale Pass. 3 years ago, we had 11 students. Last year, we had a projection of 14, but only 9 came to school. And so when the count hit, we actually lost over $330,000 because we lost the Whale Pass school. We still serve those kids. We still have those staff. We just had to find a way to make it happen. This year, that enrollment went back up to 15. So you can see a small swing can really hit us pretty hard. These fluctuations create real challenges. When funding drops suddenly, districts are forced to make immediate decisions that impact students, reducing staff, cutting electives, limiting support services, or delaying the need of program. Next slide, please. House Bill 261 helps rural districts. It will help us improve our stability using the previous year's EDM or the three-year average, whichever is greater, would significantly make our budgets more stable, providing declining enrollment phase in for sharp enrollment drops, and then strengthening the intensive service funding for predictability. And I want to talk about that just a little bit. For our rural districts, getting students services and tested is quite a challenge. We have to fly providers out, depending on the weather, give the student a battery of tests or assessments, and sometimes those students who qualify intensive happen after the count. We still have to serve those students throughout the year. And so, especially when it comes to our special ed population, the students that need a lot of support, it's really hard to predict funding when you're not sure if those kids are going to count, or after the count, intensives come in, we still have to support them. So that's an area that really excites me about the House Bill 261. It also provides a common sense solution by allowing districts to calculate funding using the greater or prior EDM versus the 3-year. We talked about that. Next slide, please. With stable funding process, REAs may allow contracts to be signed earlier or to remain consistent teacher support staff, strengthening stability and support for students in schools. As we all know, there's really kind of a hiring shortage right now, and if our teachers don't have contracts early, we're going to look at other places. So it provides a little stability and predictability when it comes to budgeting. It would protect our electives, cultural programs, and interventions. To ensure continuity for special education and intensive needs for students. Next slide, please. On behalf of the REA community, House Bill 561 recognizes the reality of rural Alaska. It stabilizes the funding process without increasing uncertainty. We respectfully urge the passage of Bill 261. Thank you for your time and your commitment to the Alaska students.
Thank you, Superintendent Morrison. Appreciate your time. Next, we're going to go to Katie Jo Parrott, President of the Alaska Association of School Business Officials. Ms. Parrott, if you could identify yourself for the record and begin your presentation. Thank you for being here.
Yes, good morning, Chair Henschut and members of the committee. My name is Katie Parrott. I am the Senior Director of the Office of Management and Budget for Anchorage School District, but this morning I'm speaking in my capacity as the President of the Alaska Association of School Business Officials, which is an organization that represents all of the finance and business operations people for Alaska school districts. Districts currently contend with too much uncertainty when it comes to financial planning and budget development. There are a variety of factors that lend to this uncertainty, as I know that you've heard in today's testimony. The variability, complexity, and unpredictability of education funding erodes public trust and compounds the challenges in an already challenging environment. So really, any effort to alleviate the year-to-year unpredictability for school districts and communities is truly a step in the right direction. HB 261 is a step toward taking the variability out of enrollment fluctuations and providing a smoothing effect that allows districts to achieve greater stability year to year than the current system provides. Districts in Alaska are statutorily required to present a balanced budget, often before major factors that underlie revenues are known. In fact, the system is designed in such a way that districts don't know what funding they'll be receiving until the school year has already commenced. And I'm going to explain that in two distinct areas. As you can imagine, this poses challenges in planning and staffing and ensuring that student needs are met. So one of those aspects of uncertainty occurred when the legislature in recent years relied on the one-time supplemental funding. And those were decisions, as you know, that were often made after most districts were required to have approved budgets for the next year and often pass the statutory deadline for layoff notices. That was really difficult. But you, your body, the legislature, took care of this variable with the historic override veto override, and then the permanent increase to the BSA. So thank you very much for that. We no longer have to wait for one-time funding decisions to be made late in the session, which is great. And as an aside, this predictability is only maintained if there's inflation proofing that's achieved as a next step. But short of that, other elements of variability in the formula need to be addressed, which I believe HB 261 does. So the other aspect of uncertainty is that the budget relies on a projection of enrollment that isn't actually known until after the October count in the year for which the budget and the academic plans have already been set. So basing future year budgets on enrollment projections has been increasingly problematic, and a few factors contribute to that. The COVID pandemic and the outmigration from communities in Alaska caused a lot of difficulty for districts in kind of making those projections and getting them right. So year-to-year changes in education programming that kind of tries to absorb that compounds that problem. So when we're doing school consolidation and restructuring resulting from budget reductions or other efforts to address staffing shortages, that presents additional pressures on the system and on communities and families and their decision making. So in short, kind of that so much change in people's decision making because the system is changing so frequently has made it really hard to accurately predict student count. And what ends up happening in the process of those fluctuations is there's a true erosion of public trust due to not fully understanding the complexities and nuances of that funding. Of those mechanisms. So when enrollment is higher than projected and the budget is modified to reflect that increase, we hear messages like the district magically found extra money, with the implication being that districts aren't being honest when they're doing their initial budgeting. When enrollment is lower than expected and there are further budget reductions that are needed mid-year, we hear the district lost money, there was mismanagement. The implication is that there was an error by district administration or true mismanagement, rather than fluctuations from well-established methods of projecting enrollment. So I'll pause here to tell you something I experienced in my first days as a business manager in Alaska. I was invited by my superintendent, who was new at the time, to sit in on a new superintendent session and to learn alongside other educational leaders across the state. And I distinctly remember a superintendent who came from another state saying, I really wish that I could stick to the business of improving outcomes, but I find myself most of the year having to be a finance and budget expert. And that really stuck with me. I think that this bill will have an immediate positive impact on the majority of districts in the state. And in fact, based on Deed's most recent foundation report, it appears that almost half of Alaska school districts are receiving some level of hold harmless in FY26. So those would be reductions of enrollment that they have to account for and then request relief. And the option in this bill to select the greater of the prior year ADN versus the three-year average really does solve the problem for those few districts that experience enrollment increases at the same time. So it kind of protects districts across the state. There may be a concern for some districts who have or expect to have really large increases in an enrollment in a single year, and so I want to acknowledge that. However, when that happens currently, the funding is not immediately provided after the student count to be able to be incorporated into that current year. The state actually goes through the process of completing their student count reconciliation and then adjusts the last three payments of the year so that the timing doesn't easily facilitate utilizing those funds in the year for which they're received anyway. The funding under this change would essentially be postponed. There's that opportunity for the district to opt into the prior year. And it would effectively still be known by the district to be able to effectively plan for their next fiscal year, if that makes sense. Additionally, the ability to request an advance from DEED for districts who are suffering from some kind of a cash flow shortage is already allowable, and there's a provision under AS 1417-610C that gives districts ability to request assistance if they're faced with a real revenue challenge. Unlike regular ADM enrollment increases, mainstream students can often be absorbed into the planned or budgeted education program. However, this bill really reflects the need for intensive needs students to have more urgent, immediate, and intensive support in order to access their education. They have different needs, so that those needs and behaviors can often be a real barrier to them immediately accessing education, and so that the immediate provision of resources then for those students specifically is really important. The change in this bill to be able to provide for those students who weren't projected or budgeted really gives districts a more agile way of meeting those immediate needs, and I think it's a good change. Additionally, allowing alternative schools under a count of 175 to be counted as a separate school only makes sense. Alternative schools tend to have smaller populations of students, but they also tend to serve a population with higher needs for instructional intervention and supports, which often requires staffing levels that are somewhat higher than other schools. Being able to treat them as a separate school and give them the credit of that resource is an important step in the right direction. And then lastly, the smoothing effects of the enrollment fluctuations for smaller districts that may be on the threshold of AS 1417-905 is also an improvement. In sum, this is a good bill that takes an incremental step toward providing Alaska schools greater stability. It's a smart and effective approach to solving Alaska's education funding challenges pending a long-term fiscal plan. Thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Parrott. And I think I failed to recognize that you are the president of the Alaska Association of School Business Officials. So thank you very much for your time and your expertise this morning. We're going to move on now, and I'm going to encourage the committee to write down your questions because we may run out of time for questions, but this bill will come back before us on Friday, and we'll try to have folks available for questions at that point. So if you're not good at keeping them in your head, write them down. Here we go. We're going to go now to Shannon Baird, Director of Finance for the Petersburg School District. Good morning, Shannon. Welcome. We're glad you're here. Please identify yourself for the record and begin your presentation.
Good morning, co-chairs and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Shannon Baird, and I serve as the Finance Director of the Petersburg School District. I want to begin by expressing our sincere appreciation for the intent and forethought behind House Bill 261. On my first slide, I hope is in front of you. The light feed's just a little behind the phone. So I first want to speak to Section 6 and 8 of House Bill 261. It is my understanding that the option to either use the prior year's ADM or an average of the three prior years would. It's meant to have a similar effect to the hold harmless language that would be removed, and that at the same time it would allow for us to know much sooner an accurate adjusted ADM for planning and budgeting. I was able to compile and extrapolate on data from fiscal year 2008 through our current fiscal year 2026. Here you can see in blue Petersburg's historical adjusted ADM or AADM. And then I did back out the hold harmless that we did receive in nine of these years. So you can see that adjusted ADM, what it would have been without full time lift, represented by that thinner yellow line. And right, sometimes these are overlapping. Now, in red, I have calculated what the adjusted ADM would have been if we applied back over the same time period, HB 261, except for Section 7, which deals with the sped-intensive ADM, but I will touch on that shortly. And then also for reference, I've provided that black line as our just straight ADM, our student population, without any factors and multipliers applied. So you can see that in some years, our historical adjusted ADM would have been better, higher funding, and then in others, HB 261 would have been. If you total the adjusted ADMs over this time period, the historic line would have provided us more in total funding, but it's very close. And you can see that they're having a similar smoothing effect, which is the intent. If we were always steadily declining, then HB 261 would always be better. However, our ADM has fluctuated up and down during this time frame, and I think it would be best to assume that it would continue to. In the years that we saw an increase in our ADM, the applied HB 261 would have meant that we would have had significantly less funding. We did, you know, have a pretty significant jump from fiscal year 23 to 24 in our student population, and if that funding had been behind, that certainly would have affected us. But the importance of having accurate and then a final adjusted ADM to use for planning would be huge. There are a lot of unknown factors, as you've already heard, that are out of our, a lot of them out of our control, right? So giving us a known variable that is, has such a large impact on our funding would certainly help us greatly with budgeting during union negotiations and staffing decisions and in strategic planning. I would like to ask the committee to consider amending HB 261 Section 8 to offer a third option for districts to use their current year ADM, similar to how Section 7 offers that for sped intensive. This is represented on the second slide and by that green line. I'm sorry, I might have not told, asked for the slide B. And I'm just a little behind on the live feed.
So, Shannon,
so that green line, I hope you're seeing.
Yeah, we're looking at the slide with the green line that starts high and drops low between FY08
okay.
and 09.
Great. So I would like to ask the committee to consider amending HB 261 to offer that third option, and it's represented by that green line. To us, in Petersburg, this would be the best of both worlds, allowing us for better planning and budgeting in declining years and overall, while letting districts take their higher current ADM in years that they are growing. When you see it, you know, a huge increase in your student population, you do have to meet some of those needs immediately. So to us, you can see this is still in line with the same intent and trends as both the blue and red lines. So our historic and HB 261. And my suggested change would have meant that the total adjusted ADM over this time period would have been 22,826, which is not much greater than the 22,700 that we historically did receive funding based on. So I hope you'll consider how that might best serve Alaskan students. And then my next slide, please. As promised, this takes a look at Section 7, which would allow us four options for our sped-intensive ADM. The greater stability and potentially increased funding this would provide would mean so much to the Petersburg School District. The number of students that might have moved or qualified by February isn't something that we have tracked long-term, but our sped director, Cindy Fry, and I were able to estimate that if HB 261 would have meant that one more, and then two more intensive students would have been counted in fiscal years 24, 25, and 26, respectively. So, and in our case, that would have meant two, three, and then two more worth of funding, respectively. Because intensive students are multiplied by 13, each one has a huge impact on our overall funding. And of course, I don't want anyone listening to think that that's just some easy way to receive 13 times the funds on students. It's a very lengthy and arduous process to get an intensive certification from DE for a sped student, and the extra funding is absolutely warranted. And if you, oh, I think you might be ahead of me now. If you will go back to that slide, that red line, of course, is HB261 without that Section 7, but that purple line does account for what we would estimate we would have had extra qualified by February.
Okay.
And if you go to my last slide, please. Thank you. There are a number of reasons why we may not have a student qualify for an October count date and why the February option is so needed. A student could move to the district between October and February, of course. A student could have enrolled the previous year, but identification, qualification, and documentation take a great deal of time. We have had intensive students leave the community mid-year, but it's more likely that one would be enrolling mid-year or qualified mid-year for us. And then the time it takes to assess, have many meetings between staff and families, document and apply for intensive certification. Our district is already meeting those students' needs and providing intensive level services, which is why this February option to capture funding for those services would be so extremely helpful. I would like to add that the great potential that the February option would provide could not have been realized in some recent years, though. In three of the last 6 years, Petersburg didn't receive final decisions from DEED on our new intensive applications until after that second count date would have occurred. So we do question whether, in practice, this would work out as intended. I imagine there are a lot, we know there are a lot of applications each year for DEED to consider, and we would just like to know if DEED has the capacity to provide consistent, timely feedback in order for that February count to be a real option for us. Of note, also quickly, Section 12 would allow for districts' true entitled state funding to be prorated equally throughout the year. Right now, we're receiving 12 payments, but the first 9 are based on projected student numbers, and the final 3, of course, are true-up payments. If you did choose to propose a change, an amendment to Section 8, that, as I've suggested, language would probably need to be added back into under Section 12 or 13 to allow for true-up payments in April through June, similar to how it's being allowed for intensive. Thank you for your time, your service, for listening to the realities that districts are facing, and for considering the great potential HB 261 has to offer through greater stability and support as we work to do what is best for Alaska's children.
Thank you, Ms. Baird. It's always great to hear from Petersburg. What we're going to do right now is I'm going to ask Senator Gray Jackson to hold for just a little bit longer, and let's do questions specific to Dr. Silverstein with Augenblick Palish and Associates about student counts, since he's not within the state, and I'm not sure we'll be able to get him back on Friday. So if you have questions on how other states, and I think in Rep. Story's slides, it would be slide 5, about how other places do student count and any pitfalls he sees with this bill or any questions he can answer about how we count and what these changes would mean to Alaska. So we're going to take a really brief at ease. My bad. I'm sorry. We're back on record. We have one more presenter I completely missed. I'm even checking things off on my list, and I just completely overlooked. Chris Brown from the Homer Flex School, Kenai Peninsula Borough School District. Apologies for not noticing your name here. If you could put your name on record and begin your presentation on House Bill 261. Thank you for being here.
No need for apologies. Good morning, co-chairs and members of the House Education Committee. My name is Christopher Brown, and I'm the principal. of and a teacher at Homer Flex, a small alternative school serving around 35 to 40 students in the southern Kenai Peninsula. I'm here to testify in support of HB 261. Our previous speakers outlined the overall impact of this bill on the school districts overall, and KPBSD is no different. But I will be speaking specifically in regards to how it addresses the school size factor in the funding formula and how that relates to alternative programs. To put it plainly, under the current system, the funding for my students is being hidden to the detriment of their education. Right now, because my alternative program is treated as a satellite of a larger, more traditional high school, rather than a distinct school site, my students' enrollment numbers are rolled into that larger school's total. The way I understand it, in the Alaska school funding formula, the first group of students at any large school or at any school generates the highest amount of funding to cover base operations. As a school gets larger, the per student funding decreases because of economies of scale. By rolling my 40 students into a school of around 700, they are counted as the last 40 students added to a massive spreadsheet. And that way they generate the lowest possible multiplier, essentially marginal funding. But my school is not marginal. We are not just an extra classroom at the end of the hallway. We are a separate facility with separate operational costs, distinct administrative needs, and a student body that requires more support and not less. HB 261 fixes this accounting error. By recognizing small alternative schools as distinct sites for funding purposes, this bill allows us to be calculated at our true size. We would trigger the small school multiplier that was designed exactly for schools like ours. This isn't about asking for a handout. It is about accessing the formula as it was intended. So what would change at our site look like? If our funding is unhidden and we receive the proper size adjustment, first of all, it means dedicated mental health staffing. Currently, we share a counselor with the main high school here in town, and we scrape together additional funding simply to increase her FTE to half-time in our building. With independent funding, we could hire a full-time mental health clinician, a non-negotiable need for at-risk youth. Second, it closes the gap in special education. A significant portion of alternative school students require SPED services. Currently, we are staffed with only a half-time SPED teacher and a half-time paraprofessional. But our students' learning disabilities and the support needs do not turn off at noon. Proper funding would allow us to expand these roles to full-time, ensuring that our students on IEPs receive consistent, reliable support rather than piecemeal assistance. Third, it saves the state money in the long run. An alternative student who graduates is a taxpayer. One who drops out because their school was under-resourced costs the state exponentially more. HB 261 stops penalizing alternative programs and starts recognizing the additional challenges we face. I urge you to pass this bill and let our funding reflect the reality of our schools. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer questions if there are any.
Thank you for your time. My oversight there was just saving the best for last, so we had to build a little suspense. I think we're going to go ahead and take a couple of minutes to go to Dr. Silverstein if folks have questions for him, just because I'm not sure we'll have him back on Friday, and maybe we will. But in the absence of that certainty, I think we'll go ahead and do questions for him. Does anyone on the committee have questions? And I'm specifically looking at page 5 in Representative Story's presentation about how other places do count. So Representative Dibert, and then we'll go to Elam after that.
Good morning. I'll try to be very quick here. Thank you through the chair to Mr. Silverstein. Thank you for being here. I was just wondering, is there a state out there that you can might feel best serve as a model for Alaska with our unique student movement and flow in and out through our districts as we look to improve our student count? Thank you.
Dr. Silverstein?
Yes, thank you, Chair. I would suggest looking at some other just small rurals, and there's a number of states who do, and they still won't all do it the same, but even states like Colorado who have bigger districts still have a lot of small rural settings, much like yourselves. I think Vermont uses a two-year average all the time, and a couple other states. I would also suggest that this kind of declining enrollment issue is the kind of the leading issue, I would think, over the next 5 to 10 years in states and for school districts. And so you guys are a little bit ahead of the curve to be thinking about a change, whereas, you know, some states have been doing it, but they've been doing it for a long time. So, again, smaller rural settings where you have, you know, these kind of changes, those types of states would be good. And again, I think Colorado, Vermont, Maryland, who is not like you all, much bigger, but they actually just made this change recently as they redid their school finance formula, very similar, three-year or current or previous year.
Thank you. Representative Elam.
Thank you. Thank you for your presentation. On slide 5, I guess my question kind of goes into this membership versus attendance. 45 states use membership, 5 states use attendance. I was hoping that maybe you could explain this a little bit more, maybe expound upon it. And then, you know, kind of going off of what Representative Dibert was saying, my school district is on the Kenai Peninsula. Geographically, it's the size of about West Virginia. And so we have, you know, 43 schools within that district. I don't know that there's another state out there that's going to be a direct model to kind of correlate data off of. But I'm just wondering, of these 5 states that use attendance, is there any kind of common theme with why they use attendance? And if we're, because I think that's kind of what you're saying here, is we're part of those 5 states. So my question would be, is what are those other 4 states and what do they have in common? Why are they similar in structure?
And if we could preface that question with an explanation of membership versus attendance, I think that would bring some clarity as well. Dr. Silverstein.
Absolutely. Thank you, Chair. So attendance, so just kind of defining, attendance means a count, and again, it could be a single day or multi-day, of the actual number of students who show up to schools. So that really is just a baseline attendance. And then membership is looking at the number of students really that schools have to serve within their population. So an example could be you have a 1,000 student membership in a district, but on any given day, you average about, you know, 950 students who actually attend. So as you're seeing here, the majority of states fund on the number of students that districts have to actually serve, and they do that in part because you're setting up, you know, the number of teachers based on the number you have to serve, not the number who are kind of on average in attendance. So there are a lot of reasons. I would need to go back and review exactly the 5 states who use attendance. There, I do not believe is a lot of consistency. California is one state who uses attendance, right? So it doesn't look really anything like you all. I would say that states have moved away from attendance over time. And the reason that they've moved away from attendance is it does tend to have the largest negative impact on your highest need communities. So if you have, generally when you have a higher need community, you tend to have a little higher, you have lower attendance rates, and thus those schools then, or districts get lower funding because of that. And in reality, those are often communities who need, you know, all the funding they can get to serve those higher need students.
Follow up, please.
Quick follow up.
Thank you. Can you help me to understand membership versus attendance from a complexities perspective? One of the issues that I've always had with how we do our funding formulas has been, it's a relatively complex system. One of the challenges I see with 261 is that I think it's adding some additional layers of complexity to that. Is there a model that simplifies some of this formula process and the funding mechanisms in this method of doing funding?
Dr. Silverstein?
No, thank you, Chair. I would probably love a little bit more just kind of clarity on what you think are the complexities in your current system. I think, you know, student counts they're not really necessarily complex, but they do take time and energy. They take time and energy for districts. They take time and energy for the state. And like any good policy decision, you're really trying to think kind of is the juice worth the squeeze as you go. I would say overall, this plan is pretty in line with how other states do this, you know, in part trying to use known data versus kind of predictive data going forward. But if you had a little, maybe some examples of what where you find those complexities, I apologize just not for knowing them. I'm happy to respond to that.
Quick follow-up?
Yeah. I mean, so if you did our foundation formula that we use here, the flow chart would be pretty extensive for the problems that we – or the complexities of how we do foundation our formula. I mean, we consistently hear about it from school districts that it is complex. And so I guess I'm not sure how to expand upon the fact that it's a lot of moving parts to figure out what is ultimately going to be funded at the end of the day because, I mean, and it's – maybe it's just Alaska, but, I mean, it's everything from – roof sizes, number of schools, the types of special needs students. I mean, there's a significant amount of – I mean, it would be a giant flow chart to get to the end of the day. Like, I don't think very many people can actually calculate out how much money goes to a student or to a school, to a district. So it's complex.
Yeah. Dr. Silverstein, I'm not sure there's a question there, but can you speak to the complexity of funding formulas in general? Like, is there any state where it's simple?
Absolutely. Thank you, Chair. No, we'd like to say every state thinks that they're the most complex, and it turns out the more we work in them, I think everyone's right. And I do think as a state, and I think this was reflected in our 2015 study, as you mentioned, you face unique challenges based on your demographics and your size and everything else, and I would – you know, kind of applaud the state for trying to get to that level of specificity. But I agree, you know, when you look at the structure of your formula, so, you know, way off this slide five, but the structure of your formula and kind of the multiplicative approaches in it, you actually have some places that appear to have specificity that don't. And I, you know, and that's sometimes you just have some common multipliers in those pieces. And so I do think there are ways to kind of simplify your foundation formula. I think the count itself is, and this approach to the count is, you know, I'm not going to say it's the right approach because there isn't a right approach, but it is it's a well thought out approach and it's one that is pretty common to other places. And it would allow you, if you decide to make other changes to your formula, it would feed kind of those types of changes really well. I don't think you'd have to come back and redo this base student count in order to make any other kind of changes to simplify your formula.
Thank you. That kind of gets to the gist of what I was trying to get at is I would love to hear some ideas on how we simplify this process.
And I think the good news is OASIS doesn't necessarily change at all. It's just how we use the information we're already getting. So Representative Schwanke, quick question.
Yes, thank you through the chair. Dr. Silverstein, I just want to come back to enrollment really quick. So one of the things that I observe being a school board member over the 6 years was that there's obviously a national shortage of teachers. And what ends up happening is that there is a rush by school districts to try to get their recruitment out early. And through that process, contracts were offered earlier. So I don't know what it was when you started teaching, but when I started on the board, I think contracts were let out in March, and then they were February, and then they were January. My concern is that we're working, we're trying to catch up here. So my question to you is, are you seeing this problem in other states as well as far as districts moving in a, or states moving in a position in a way that they need to get funding earlier so that they can secure their contracts earlier? And what should we expect kind of on a national level with this problem?
Dr. Silverstein?
Yeah, thank you. And I do, just to clarify, I do not have my doctorate. I appreciate
apologies.
It. I'm married to a doctor, and I'm surrounded by doctors all the time in my business. But
I just prefer to aim high.
I have not
in
succeeded
case.
In doing that yet, so I appreciate it, though. I'm not sure I have a perfect answer for your question. I really have appreciated listening to the districts and how and their thoughts of how this kind of change could align to a better approach to, you know, allowing them to know in the hiring process. I think we are hearing a lot across the country as we work about the lack of teachers and you know, the kind of the stories of, well, we used to get 30 to 50 teachers applying, and now we get, zero to five. And so I do think, you know, having a line of sight where you know at least two-thirds of your calculus in this enrollment or in the funding calculation pretty early on gives districts a little bit more predictability. I don't think we, nothing we see across the country is saying that the shortage is going to turn anytime soon. And so I think any way you can help districts kind of think about that, this being, one small way you could do that, would be helpful.
We'll move on.
Okay, thanks. I do have one very quick question. I hope it's quick. Mr. Silverstein, could you enlighten me as to the wisdom behind taking the smallest school and wrapping it into the biggest school? What's the purpose of that?
Thank you, Chair. I would probably lean, I can tell you what we learned about it. That was not really, I believe that was in place before our study. And so I would maybe ask, I know there were some other state-level finance experts there who could probably answer that better than I could.
Okay. Thank you for that.
But let me just quickly say, but what we did recommend is in any place where those kind of choices created cliffs, that's one of the things that this bill does clean up and that we really recommend, because those kind of cliffs where you lose a bunch of funding for losing one kid is a real issue for districts.
That sounds great. And I think anybody who could answer that question for me can come back on Friday. So I think at this point, I'm going to wrap up my part of chairing today and give it back to a more capable chair. So thanks to everybody for your testimony today. Did you want to give some final comments?
Yes. Thank you. And thank you, everyone who testified today and gave their perspective on this. I wanted to say that the bill is up on Friday. We just got the fiscal notes, so we will get them out to you, and we look forward to answering any questions that you may have on Friday. So thank you, and thanks again to the presenters.
Okay. Thanks for your presentation earlier, Rep. Story, and I'm going to hand the gavel back to Rep. Story now.
We're back on the record. I'm really glad that next we will have and invite Senator Gray Jackson and her staff, Clark Pickford, to the table. Please identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony. Sorry to keep you waiting, but I hope you found it interesting to listen to the presentation. Thank you, Senator. Please introduce yourself.
Good morning. This is Senator Elvie Gray Jackson, representing District G in Anchorage. And I want to start out by saying thank you to the co-chair so much for hearing this in the House Education Committee for hearing this bill today and giving me the opportunity to speak on Senate Bill 6. I'm honored to introduce this legislation, which seeks to strengthen our education system by ensuring that the history and contributions of Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders are accurately and meaningfully included in Alaska's public school curriculum. Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders, they've played an important role in shaping both our state and our nation, yet their histories and contributions have too often been overlooked in traditional curricula. So by passing Senate Bill 6, we can ensure that Alaska students receive a more complete and well-rounded education, one that reflects the diverse cultures, histories, and contributions that have helped build our communities. This bill is not only about education, it is about representation, inclusion, and ensuring future generations understand the rich history of the people who have contributed to Alaska's growth and prosperity. During the COVID-19 pandemic, we witnessed a troubling rise in discrimination and hate toward Asian communities. In response, the United States Commission on Civil Rights recommended that states incorporate Asian American and Pacific Islander history into K-12 curricula as a way to educate students early, foster understanding, and promote respect for the contributions these communities have made to our nation and to Alaska. Colleagues, Senate Bill 6 is a meaningful step toward providing our students with a more complete and accurate education. It reinforces our commitment to diversity, equity, and historical integrity. Importantly, this bill carries no fiscal impact. That's the good news, which is especially compelling at a time of fiscal uncertainty for our state. Therefore, I respectfully ask for your support in moving this bill forward. And thank you again for hearing this bill this morning. Thank you, Madam Co-Chairs.
Thank you, Senator. I noticed that we have one invited testifier for Senate Bill 6 in the room, and we have one of our testifiers online. I know we have short on time. Would you prefer to take questions right now, or would you like us to hear from the testifiers?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like you to hear from the testifiers.
Okay.
Thank you.
So first up in the room today, I invite Kay Rolden from Make Us Visible, co-director. Welcome.
Hello, thank you. Let me move this down. Good morning, co-chairs, Representative Hemshute and Representative Story, and members of the House of Education Committee. Thank you so much for the opportunity to provide testimony on Senate Bill 6, an act requiring education on the history and contributions of Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders. My name is Kay Roldan. I'm a co-director of Make Us Visible Alaska. I'm a board member of the Filipino Community Inc. of Juneau and a 33-year Juneau resident. Today I'm testifying on behalf of Make Us Visible Alaska. I'd like to add I'm also a former Juneau School District student, having completed my education here from pre-K all the way to college at UAS, where I earned my degree in elementary education. Being a former student and an educator, this bill is deeply important to me. Throughout my K-12 education, I did not learn about Filipino history. It wasn't until a college course at UAS where our history was briefly mentioned, and even then, only about 15 minutes. It focused on cannery and mining labor, but growing up at the Filipino Community Hall, I knew that our stories, there was so much more to be shared that wasn't being present, so what I learned in college felt incomplete. Teaching AAPI history matters because representation helps students feel seen and valued. When students see themselves reflected in what they learn, it sends a powerful message: you belong here. That sense of belonging builds pride and confidence and empathy, not just for AAPI students, but for the entire classroom. Inclusive education is also a preventative measure. It can counter harmful stereotypes, reduce bullying, and prevent internalized shame. I believe it was Dr. Walter Soboloff who said, "When you know yourself, you don't harm yourself." I believe Senate Bill 6 can interrupt cycles of harm by affirming identity, dignity, and belonging. Ultimately, Senate Bill 6 can create a ripple effect, helping students value themselves, understand one another, and build stronger, more connected communities. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you for your testimony. I wanted to note that Senator Kawasaki has joined us. Do I have any questions for Ms. Rolden? Yes, Rep. Schwanke.
Thank you, through the chair. Thank you, Ms. Rolden, correct? Okay, for being here. I have a question about the history of what you've observed in the local community. So I, too, graduated from JDHS, and I grew up in the interior, so I got to know several Filipino friends here. My volleyball team was the shortest in the state because of a few of my awesome friends that didn't break 5 foot, but we were very successful in our endeavors. So over the time, I recognize there's a fairly large Philippine community here, and I'm sort of curious, how have you seen educational opportunities pertaining to your cultural history and background change within this school district over your lifetime?
Thank you. Yes, through the chair, through Representative Schwinkie, thank you for your question. I haven't seen many opportunities, but I will say it wasn't until I joined the board of of the Filipino Community Hall, where I got to learn more stories and more about our history and the contributions of Filipinos to the state. The opportunities that I've seen within the school district have been through events, maybe multicultural events, and where we can table and share information about our community. I feel like there's been a great push to also include us, and people have reached out to the Juneau Filipino Community Hall to, you know, include us in sharing more information in our histories. And I'm, you know, still learning, a you know, lifelong learner. So I think this bill can also encourage that more inclusive share out of our history and stories, and we can bring in our community to share their own stories and their contributions. And so that's the most that I've seen through the school district. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much for your testimony this morning. I'm going to now go to, we have a testifier online. I'm going to now go to Shanae Nuska, Make Us Visible co-director, and she comes to us online this morning. And if you could please introduce yourself and begin your presentation. Welcome.
Thank you, Co-Chair Story, Co-Chair Hemshute, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. For the record, my name is Shane Nuweska. I grew up in Anchorage and have lived here for nearly 30 years. I'm originally from the Philippines and emigrated to the U.S. when I was 6 years old. I'm a co-director of Make Us Visible Alaska and a co-founder of MANA, a group recording Filipino-American history across our state, because to this day, there's still only one book published about our history here. I'm calling in support of Senate Bill 6 because I know how it feels when students don't see themselves in what they're learning. Asian American and Pacific Islander communities have been part of Alaska for generations through military service, labor, fisheries, and community leadership. But those stories are often missing from classrooms, and there is so much more to be shared. Right now, in this moment, in our country, students are searching for connection and answers. Learning our shared history helps young people better understand one another and their place in the world. And to reiterate what my co-director stated, for AAPI students especially, seeing themselves reflected in the curriculum sends a simple but powerful message. You belong here. I also want to emphasize that this bill is being supported by community organizations across the state, and there are many free resources already available to support teachers. SB 6 gives Alaska an opportunity to lead with honesty, care, and respect for our shared history. I urge you to please support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Nuweska. Thank you for coming in online today, and I'm wondering if we have any questions from the committee. I see no questions. Oh, I guess Rep. Hemshute has a question.
Thank you, through the chair. Thank you for being here, Senator Gray Jackson, and thank you for the bill. My question is on line 11 of the bill. It says instruction, well, it starts with each school district shall establish and provide to students in kindergarten through grade 12 a program that includes instructional materials that portray the cultural and economic diversity of Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders. We heard from the invited testimony that there are free resources to support teachers. How does that connection get made between the free resources and the teachers? So it says it will be provided, and so how is it provided?
Excuse me, for the record, Clark Pickford. Thank you for the question. We have a deputy director from DEED here today, Kelly Manning, and I think she can speak to how it would be implemented better than we can, but to my understanding, there's an employee in the school districts that will work with DEED, and they will have a comprehensive plan for this curriculum. And so because the fiscal note is zero, I think the original version of the bill had the approval through the department, but now that approval is based on school districts across the state only. And so they would be working with DEED to have a comprehensive curriculum. And she can probably speak to it better than I can, but.
Thank you, Mr. Pickford. Is Deputy Director Manning here? Yes, you are. Please come forward, put your name on the record, and help us learn the answer to that question.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Kelly Manning, Deputy Director for the Division of Innovation and Education Excellence. And to the question for how we would support districts with implementing, as Mr. Bickford shared, we have a part-time social studies content specialist at the department, and they would work to create but collect resources that are available that districts can use at the local level. Because it's not being approved at the department level, it would be more of resource gathering, sending information. So the content specialist would identify what's available and then share with districts and provide resources as they are seeking information for building their local curriculum in response to the legislation.
Thank you. Rep. Elam.
Thank you. I've been trying to kind of think about a way to phrase this in a way that didn't seem harsh, so please bear with me just a moment. But is this going to be ultimately considered one of those unfunded mandates that we hear about all the time?
Senator Helvey Gray Jackson, would you like to answer that?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And through the chair, Representative Elam, no. Thank you.
Rep. Tybert.
Thank you, through the co-chair. Thank you for bringing this bill forward, Senator Alvigar Jackson. This might be a question, I'm not sure for who. In my past life, I did write curriculum that intertwined Alaska Native knowledge and Western scientific knowledge, and I had a grant for that, so it was funded differently, but it was always a challenge to try to get that curriculum out to the teachers. I was wondering if there is a clearinghouse on the DEED website where you have these social, I think they're social studies content available for different districts, or where they can go to Alaska Native cultural curriculum or Asian American curriculum or any other topic. Thank you.
Through the chair, to Member Dybert, with the passage of our new social studies standards, we're actually have been working to build out those resources to support the new standards. So as we're building those, anything that, you know, like this would be incorporated into that, and that is one of the things that our new standards do incorporate more, Alaska Native history in particular, across grade levels. So that is something that particular content is being resources are being made more available to support the updated standards. But that is something that we're building out in alignment with the new standards, is more resource, more of like a website resources that people can go to and find and see what's available across the content of the standards.
Follow up?
Yes, through the co-chair. Thank you so much, because I work in a Title I school, and when I go to teach my students, I want to make sure that I'm, you know, I have a high number of students of diversity, and I think it's important, you know, when you teach about other cultures, it rises everyone up in the classroom, and so I just thank you for that and for making it available to educators. It's helpful.
Thank you for that comment, Rep. Eichheit.
Thank you, Co-Chair Story. First of all, I just want to say to the bill sponsor, I think it's a fantastic idea, and thank you for bringing that before us. I think this question is for Deed. As a longtime teacher myself, you know, I know what standards are, so could you provide, you know, at a later date, the specific social studies standards that this bill would be congruent with or address? That would be just helpful for me. Thank you.
Yeah, through the chair, we can follow up and provide that.
Yes, thank you. And thank you both. Thank you, Senator, for being with us today. I did have a question, and I know you'll be back before us on Friday, and we're taking public testimony on Friday, but I would be curious how districts see how they can network with the department. I know we did have a virtual library that we set up as part of the Alaska Reads Act. It would be helpful to know how the department too is using that resource to make teachers aware, our school staff aware that this curriculum or these materials will be on the library and be on that library and available to others. I'd just like to see how everything is networking together on this. So, thank you. Any other questions? Oh, Rep. Underwood.
I know. I have 2 seconds. I just was curious on the implementation of it. Thank you, Senator Gray Jackson, for bringing this forward. So, just for my understanding, like, if is this being kind of integrated into current social studies, like they would just take a semester or a couple class periods? Do you know what the requirements would be on how long they would have to teach on this type of a subject and just the integration of that? I'm just curious how that would work.
Through the co-chairs, thank you, Representative Underwood. My understanding is that it will be integrated with current social studies. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much for bringing this bill before us and for answering our questions. And I'm going to move on to kind of our wrap-up. So we will see you on Friday.
Thank you,
did you have a comment?
No, I just want to say thank you, co-chairs, and thank you, Education Committee as a whole, for hearing this bill this morning. Thank you.
Sounds good. So this Wednesday, the committee will hold our first sub-finance committee meeting from 8 to 10. And then again during the first hour on Friday, February 6th. Following that, the House Education Committee will take up both bills that we heard today, House Bill 261 and Senate Bill 6, and take public testimony on each. So this concludes our meeting today. The time is 9:58. And the